The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Valvular and congenital heart disease is presented by Dr. Robert Bender.
Got a lot of information to get through, so put your seatbelt on. We're going to be moving fairly fast here. So we're going to start with valve disease, and this is a very important point. A few years ago, the American Heart Association changed their recommendations for antibiotic prophylaxis prior to dental procedures. So currently, only the patients with the highest risk should receive antibiotic prophylaxis prior to any dental procedure. So those are ones that have a prosthetic valve or have previous history of endocarditis. Although we don't see this very much, occasionally you'll have an adult that has complex congenital disease, and also cardiac transplant patients that have underlying valve disease. But the big ones are any prosthetic valve or valve repair and or patients with previous history of endocarditis. So routine antibiotic prophylaxis for patients that have native valve disease and no prior history of endocarditis is no longer recommended. Okay, let's start. The first valve lesion will be mitral stenosis. Almost all patients that have mitral stenosis, it's due to rheumatic heart disease. There's usually about at least a 20-year latency from an episode of acute rheumatic fever when they're a child until they develop significant MS. There are some other very uncommon or rare causes, such as congenital MS. The one thing that we are seeing a little bit more frequently than we have in the past, and up until I would say the past couple years, I don't think I ever referred a patient to be considered for a procedure who had developed severe MS, not from rheumatic heart disease, but from severe mitral annular calcification. And these are very difficult patients to treat because they don't do well with standard mitral valve replacement. Luttenbacher syndrome, I don't even think I've ever seen one of those. I put it on here because that's the type of thing they like to put on board. So it's somebody with an ASD who also develops mitral stenosis. The hemodynamics of mitral stenosis, we tend to grade the severity based on the mitral valve area and mitral valve gradient. But you should understand that for any valve area, the gradient will depend on the flow. And you'll see in a moment why that's important clinically. But as the flow increases across the valve, the gradient will go up. If the gradient goes up, left atrial pressure goes up, and patients will subsequently develop symptoms of dyspnea or frank heart failure. So you need to be aware of things that can increase blood flow across the valve. So in patients with MS who were previously asymptomatic will frequently develop symptoms when they, say, have a febrile illness or go into AFib with a rapid heart rate, which increases the flow, or have hyperthyroidism or have anemia. Anything that increases the flow is going to increase that gradient. And therefore, patients that have significant MS but had not previously been symptomatic may develop symptoms when they develop some other medical issue that increases the blood flow across the valve and thus the mitral valve gradient. You can see there in the mitral valve area what we consider the cutoffs for severe and very severe, but probably the most important one to remember is a valve area less than 1.5 centimeter squared. At that point in time, usually the mean mitral valve gradient is going to be greater than 10 at rest. All right. Somebody help me out here getting the, there we go. So this is the tracing in the cath lab. The you can see it's labeled left atrium, left ventricle, and the crosshatched area. That is the, just represents the gradient between the left atrium and the left ventricle in someone with mitral stenosis. Many years, actually decades ago, this was really the only way to adequately assess the gradient across the valve. Of course, nowadays, most of these patients are going to have adequate assessment of both valve area and mitral gradient with an echocardiogram. Symptoms, we won't spend much time on symptoms because with all valve lesions, the most common symptom is dyspnea. Ortner syndrome, I don't think I've ever seen that either. And it would be exceedingly rare to see somebody nowadays who gets to the point where they develop hoarseness due to compression of the left recurrent laryngeal nerve. But these were patients, prior to the advent of surgical repair of valves that would develop a massive left atrium, and it would end up compressing the left recurrent laryngeal nerve. Anyway, this is the type of thing they like to put on boards. That's the main reason why I include it here. The typical findings, or the classic findings on auscultation: early diastolic opening snap with a low-pitched diastolic rumble. And generally, as the mitral stenosis gets worse over time, the murmur gets longer. Probably the most important point on this slide is that in patients that have mitral stenosis, if they develop atrial fibrillation, the DOACs are not indicated. Okay, so the two big categories of patients where the direct oral anticoagulants are not indicated are patients with mitral stenosis and patients that have had previous mechanical valve replacement. Clearly the most important non-invasive test is the echo, and it's pretty, once you've seen a couple cases of patients with MS, it's pretty easy to pick up. You have typical changes with thickening of the leaflets and restriction of the tip of the leaflets, but probably the most important piece of information we get is the gradient across the valve, and are also able to calculate the valve area. This is just a, did that show up? No. You can see the body of the leaflets, not too thick, but the tips of the leaflets very thick and are kind of sticky. And this is fairly straightforward when you see this emotion on an echo. I won't spend much time really on appropriate medical therapy. I mean, obviously, if the patients that with MS who develop atrial fibrillation, and AFib is actually quite common in these patients, they need to be anticoagulated. I already mentioned the importance of heart rate control, because remember, anything that drives the heart rate up will drive the gradient up, and so it can convert an asymptomatic to a symptomatic patient. But the most important thing here really is the decision when to send them either to the cath lab or to the OR to have the valve hopefully repaired, but in some cases it needs to be replaced. So it's kind of a no-brainer if the patient has severe mitral stenosis and has developed symptoms. But what about in the asymptomatic patient? Is there any indication for valve repair or replacement? So if they have very severe MS and the valve looks favorable for balloon valvuloplasty, It's reasonable to send these patients. You can see it's a class 2A recommendation. So class 1 means usually definitely do it. Class 2A means probably, and 2B, if you see 2B recommendations, that kind of means maybe, but it's unclear whether there's benefits. So very severe MS, absence of symptoms, but the valve is favorable to balloon valvuloplasty. Probably those patients should be going for therapy. A little bit less clear whether patients with severe MS with new onset AFib, but otherwise asymptomatic, require repair or replacement of the valve yet. Okay, let's move on to MR. This is obviously a much more common problem. Everybody sees a lot of mitral regurgitation. Not everything ends up needing to have the valve repaired or replaced, but it's a very common valve lesion. And I think the important points here are that any abnormality of the mitral valve leaflets or the remainder of the mitral valve apparatus, which includes the annulus, the chordae, the papillary muscle, and also very importantly is the ventricle, because they all kind of work together. So if you develop a significant problem with the left ventricle, either a post-infarction, LV dysfunction, or a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, and the geometry of the ventricle changes, this actually can result in mitral regurgitation and sometimes severe MR. But the most common cause of isolated MR that requires repair or replacement is mitral valve prolapse, by far. Talk a little bit more about this in a minute. So mitral regurgitation is a volume overloaded state which results in eccentric hypertrophy. That doesn't mean that part of the ventricle is thick and part isn't. What that means is that the mass volume ratio stays the same. So the ventricle may get a little bit thicker, but it also gets bigger, as opposed to a pressure overloaded valve lesion such as with aortic stenosis, where generally the ventricle does not get bigger in size, but the walls become thicker. The other important point here is that when mitral regurgitation first becomes significant, generally the ejection fraction will go up because you have a kind of low pressure pop-off valve, and that some of the blood is regurgitating backwards into the left atrium. So you have a reduction in afterload. So if you see somebody with severe mitral regurgitation and they have an ejection fraction that is seemingly normal but less than 60%, that is abnormal. And you'll see the importance of that as far as decision-making process for repair, replacement of the valves, how that comes into play. With both regurgitant lesions we're going to talk about today, MR and AR, but since MR is more significantly more common, important point here is that symptoms may appear late. In other words, you may develop significant dysfunction of the left ventricle before the patient develops symptoms. You do not want to let someone get to that point, because even if you repair or replace the valve, the long-term outcome is not as good. So they don't do as well. So you want to avoid having patients develop dysfunction of the left ventricle, which means either the left ventricle gets bigger or the ejection fraction drops. The classic heart murmur is a holosystolic murmur loudest at the apex, which more commonly radiates to the axilla, but not always. It may radiate toward the base of the heart, and the direction that it radiates is at least in part dependent on the type of abnormality of the valve and which leaflet is involved. Echo by far is usually the key to not only detecting MR, but making a determination as to the cause of the mitral regurge, and also quantifying the severity of the MR. There are occasional patients where even after transthoracic and transesophageal echo, it's still sometimes difficult to gauge the severity. So, you know, I will add that although, you know, it's very easy to get an echo, there are sometimes discordant findings between how the patient is doing clinically and what you're seeing on the echo. And actually, cardiac MRI now is a very good test generally for quantifying regurgitant lesions. It's just that it's not as readily available as getting an echo, at least in most centers. This is just a demonstration of a milder, modest mitral regurgitant jet that you can see. This is the left ventricle, left atrium, and you can see a color flow jet regurgitating back into the left atrium. And this is the same thing, except you have a much larger jet, much broader at the point that it crosses the valve. And this is just kind of giving an idea what someone with severe MR, what the color flow looks like. These are hemodynamics tracings. These are actually from a patient of mine. And you can see, you can see here V waves, large V waves. And the reason why we know that's a V wave because it occurs just after the T wave. And in this patient, they were so prominent that even on the pulmonary artery tracing, it's reflected back and you can see that. So you should be aware of what V waves are. Obviously, this is occurring in the left atrium because this is a patient with MR, so you're not going to see that. But if you had a patient with TR and it was occurring, you had prominent V waves in the right atrium, that is something that you can actually see in the jugular venous pulse. Not really going to spend much, you know, with most valve lesions, you know, there's some important medical issues, but most of this is about the decision-making process, when to send a patient to have the valve repaired or replaced. And like with most of the lesions, you know, patients that have symptoms and have severe MR, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer. But what about the patients that have severe MR but don't yet have symptoms? Remember I said that some patients will develop left ventricular dysfunction before the onset of symptoms. You hopefully do not want to allow that to occur, because then even if you fix the MR with repair replacement of the valve, they tend not to do as well. So there are some other indications for sending a patient either to the cath lab or to the OR to have the valve fixed, besides those that have symptoms. So you can see here dysfunction of the left ventricle. And, you know, normally we think of ejection fraction in the 55 to 60% range as being normal, but in someone with severe MR, that's not the case. So if the ejection fraction drops below 60%, that's actually considered left ventricular dysfunction. Or if the ventricle becomes large and a little bit less... less robust indication, and probably the biggest, hopefully you don't see too many of these patients, but in people that have severe MR, they develop left ventricular dysfunction, but the ventricle now is severely impaired. You have to be very careful, because many of these patients will have the valve repaired or replaced, and they'll still continue to do very poorly. This, I think, is beyond the scope of this talk, but, you know, in the past, the only option was to have the valve repaired or replaced in the OR, so open heart surgery. That is now changing. There's still ongoing trials with catheter-based intervention on the mitral valve. I think it's beyond the scope of this talk to get into that, but I think in coming years, you will probably see more of that. So instead of going to the OR, they'll go to the cath lab and either have the valve repaired or even replaced with a catheter, similar to what we do with the aortic valve. This is just a summary of the guidelines. So I put this one in for mitral regurg because, you know, it's other than AS, this is the next most common valve lesion that you're going to see the most of and have to make decisions on. So it's we've basically walked down this side of the slide, and you can see at the bottom the indications for surgery. What I do want to point out now is on the other side of the slide, all the decision-making process that I was just talking about is for primary mitral regurge. In other words, where the problem is the valve leaflets. It's actually more common, though, to see patients with secondary MR, and those are the patients where the problem is not the valve, the problem is the ventricle. So these patients, it is really unclear what to do with these patients. Usually the approach is you do everything you can medically. If they have appropriate indications for cardiac resynchronization therapy, in other words, put a biventricular ICD or biventricular pacer, you go ahead and do that. But then some of these patients, despite best medical therapy, the ventricle continues to do poorly. They continue to have what you think is severe MR. And then the question becomes, well, if we fix the MR, is that going to make the patient better? And frequently in these patients, since the problem is the ventricle, you fix the MR and they still don't do better. But we're gathering more information on that, and there may be a subsegment of these patients that will do better by getting rid of the mitral regurgitation. And I think in the future, you'll probably see more of these patients being referred to have catheter-based interventions. But at the present time, it's frequently not done, and it's kind of a tough decision how to tease out which patients might benefit from mitral valve repair or replacement. So primary MR, those are the ones that are kind of, the decision making is generally straightforward. Secondary MR, those patients are pretty tough because the problem is not the valve, the problem is the ventricle. Okay, what about mitral valve prolapse? It's uncommon, but certainly not rare, about 5 to 10% of the general population. And most patients that have it, it's frequently picked up on an echocardiogram that was ordered for some other reason. Most of these patients are asymptomatic, but they can develop palpitations, atypical chest pain. I think the important points here are, what's the typical finding on physical exam? So these typical auscultatory findings are a mid-systolic click with a late systolic murmur. Certainly a small percentage of these patients will go on to develop significant mitral regurgitation, and at that point generally the physical exam changes because they can then develop a typical holosystolic murmur that you hear with MR. The only important point here is that there's an increased incidence of Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome in these patients, so that may be important from a board standpoint. As already mentioned, really, the echo is the most important non-invasive test that will not only show you the prolapse of the leaflets. You can see in this case the anterior leaflet is prolapsing back into the left atrium, but we're also able to quantitate the degree of mitral regurgitation. So some of these patients may go years or even forever with mitral valve prolapse and never develop significant dysfunction of the valve. However, some of these patients will over time develop progressive MR. And then there's a small number of patients, but I've seen this happen a number of times. A patient has mitral valve prolapse, has mild MR, is doing fine, and then suddenly either presents to your office or to the ER with profound dyspnea. And that so these patients can develop spontaneous chordal rupture and go from having little or no MR to having severe MR, and which will obviously prompt you to do something about the valve. Let's move on to aortic stenosis, the most common valve lesion that we generally intervene on. Generally degenerative, so-called senile calcific is more common than congenital aortic stenosis, which is more common than rheumatic. It's pretty rare to see a patient that presents for treatment of aortic stenosis due to rheumatic heart disease, and if you do, they'll usually have concomitant mitral valve disease, so they'll have MS. I mean, it's possible to see somebody with isolated AS from rheumatic heart disease, but in this day and age, it's pretty rare. But it's not rare to see the elderly or very elderly patient with senile calcific or degenerative AS, and also patients that are less than the very elderly are those patients with a congenitally abnormal valve, which is usually means a bicuspid valve. And you can see there, it's certainly not common, but it's not rare. 1 to 2% of the general population is thought to have a bicuspid valve. So it's the most common congenital heart abnormality. And many of these patients will go on to develop, they may have a normal function when they're born, but as they age, you'll get premature thickening, sclerotic change of the valve with reduced leaflet restriction and development of severe AS. But this will usually happen at a younger age than what you see with the very elderly who have the so-called degenerative or senile calcific AS. So if you see a patient that has severe AS and is less than, say, 70 or 75 years of age, most likely, even if you can't determine on an echo the number of leaflets, most of the, you know, if you were going to bet, it would be that that patient has an underlying congenitally abnormal valve. So this is, as I already mentioned briefly earlier, this is a pressure overload on the left ventricle that results in concentric LVH, which means the mass volume ratio goes up. There's supposed to be an arrow there, increased mass volume ratio, which means ventricle, the walls get thicker, but the ventricle doesn't get bigger. The critical values from a hemodynamic standpoint are the, and this is information that we generally gather from echo. I would say that it's very unusual to have to send somebody to the cath lab to ascertain the severity of the aortic stenosis nowadays. This is almost always done with echo. And the mean gradient and peak velocity of the blood flow across that valve are probably the main things to focus on. So when you get an echo report back on a patient of yours, you want to look for that information. If they haven't provided that for you on the echo report, then there's something wrong with the patient reading the echoes. I would say it would be a mistake to rely on reports of aortic valve area in patients that have a preserved left ventricle. The focus should be on the mean gradient and peak flow velocity. And I make a point of this because there frequently is a discrepancy between the severity of the aortic stenosis based on the valve area and that based on the looking at the mean gradient or peak flow velocity across the valve. So severe AS generally is when the mean gradient is 40 or higher, or you have a peak flow velocity across the valve of 4 meters per second or higher. And generally at this point, the valve area is going to be less than 1 centimeter squared. When you follow patients with aortic stenosis and you pick them up before they have gotten to the point where the valve lesion is severe, it is very difficult. There are some general rules about how quickly the valve lesion will progress, but I think in any one patient, it's very difficult to predict that. So that implies that there is value to doing serial echo on these patients. And generally, if they have mild AS, we'll get an echo usually at least every 3 years or so. And if they have more than mild AS, they're usually going to get an echo once a year, in addition to clinically evaluating the patient, the importance of which will become apparent in a minute. This is a cath lab tracing showing you the gradient between the left ventricle and the aorta. This is the aortic pressure trace, and you can see the pressure in the left ventricle is higher. You can see there's a gradient between the peak pressures in the ventricle and the aorta. And if you average these gradients by digitizing the area under the graph, you would get a mean gradient. But as I said, it's really exceedingly uncommon. You have to send somebody to the cath lab to grade the severity of AS. Most of the time, you're going to be able to do it with echo. This is just average survival. Is about 3 years after onset of symptoms if you don't treat these patients. But of course, nowadays, even in patients that previously were seemingly too frail or had other medical issues that would perhaps prohibit going to the OR to replace a valve, Nowadays, with the kind of explosion in transcatheter aortic valve replacement, most patients will get treated. And we frequently don't see them get to the point where they develop frank heart failure before, you know, at least seeing somebody that's going to prompt a recommendation to have the valve replaced. And this is a valve lesion, at least in adults. We don't repair, we replace the valve. Typical pulses, you should know these are actually clinically relevant and also important for boards. Pulsus parvus and tardus, that's reduced amplitude with delayed upstroke of the carotid pulse. And I actually find this helpful. The only thing is I would say in the very elderly, just because of age-related changes to the vessel, sometimes you may feel the pulse and it feels fairly good despite them having severe AS. So in the very elderly patient, this may be a less sensitive piece of the clinical exam. The important thing here on auscultation is the classic murmurs, the systolic ejection murmur, loudest at the base, generally will radiate up toward the carotid arteries. Sometimes it radiates toward the apex, and all this may not be a clinically relevant issue for boards. You should probably know what the Gallivarden phenomenon is, and that is just when the murmur radiates prominently toward the apex. And generally, as the AS becomes more severe, the murmur will get longer, louder, and peak later. And some physicians that I've worked with in the past that are very good at bedside exam is usually pretty good about grading the severity of AS just based on the physical exam. The only thing important on this slide is that, so most patients, when they get to the point of having severe aortic stenosis, most of them are going to have left ventricular hypertrophy on EKG. But the important point here is not that 80% or so are going to have LVH, it's that a not insignificant number will not have LVH. So if you don't have LVH on the EKG, that doesn't mean that the aortic stenosis can't be severe. This is just the EKG tracing showing you perhaps typical LVH changes on the 12-lead EKG. You can see some secondary repolarization changes here in the lateral precordial leads, as well as large QRS voltage. Certainly things like EKG changes like this would be, I think, fair game on internal medicine boards. Once again, the importance of echo cannot be stressed enough. And the importance is not only in identifying the fact that the patient has aortic stenosis, but hopefully assessing the status of the left ventricle, but also in people that have congenital disease. In other words, the patient with a bicuspid aortic valve, you need to get a good assessment of the ascending aorta, because a not insignificant percentage of these patients will also have concomitant dilated aorta and occasionally will require or will need to go to the OR to have the ascending aneurysm fixed even before the valve has become significantly dysfunctional. So do not forget to assess the aorta on patients that have bicuspid aortic valve. This is a tricuspid valve, but one that has become thickened, calcified, and you can see if this was during systole that the opening here is relatively small. That's a short axis view on echo. I'm not going to bore you with these, but this is the typical Doppler spectral analysis signal. Doppler actually measures the velocity of blood cells, and you can see here that the peak velocity, this is across, they direct the ultrasound beam across the aortic valve. You can see it's a very high peak velocity in this patient, nearly 6 meters per second. I already mentioned earlier, the cutoff is for severe is 4 meters per second. So just based on this, in a patient that has findings like this, you would generally surmise that the degree of their aortic stenosis is severe. So this is and I put surgical in quotation marks because it's really, this is a, you have to replace the valve disease. And in many institutions now, Instead of going to the operating room, the valve is now replaced with a catheter, so-called TAVR, which is acronym for transcatheter aortic valve replacement. And I know we are doing more and more of these in our institution. And over time, it started out where TAVR was really for the patients, for the sickest patients that had severe AS but were not good surgical candidates. And it now has kind of trickled down, and at the very least, candidates that are patients that are a moderate surgical risk, so high surgical risk, also moderate surgical risk, are candidates for TAVR. And it appears that probably the indications are going to, the bar is going to be lowered, lowered even further, and low risk surgical patients will also probably be given the option for transcatheter replacement. Oh, one other thing. This will answer it on this slide. So, again, the important point about treating these patients is, when do you recommend intervention? In other words, when do you tell the patient you need to have your valve replaced? Well, it's pretty simple in AS, because generally patients don't get to the point where they develop left ventricular dysfunction before onset of symptoms, generally. So most of the patients and most of the decision making is going to be, you do have a patient with AS, you follow them over time, the AS gradually gets worse, and it will get worse. So when you have somebody with AS, you're obligated to let that patient know that there is no medical therapy that's going to slow the progression of the disease. It will gradually get worse. It usually happens very slowly over years. But the only effective therapy, at least at the present time, is to replace the valve. So they need to be followed. And generally, you know, as far as deciding when to intervene, it's when the patient develops symptoms. So they have severe AS, they develop symptoms, and by far the most common symptom is dyspnea. That's the time to intervene. You don't want to let them continue on having symptoms and perhaps progress to the point of heart failure. You want to intervene as soon as you identify that they're having symptoms that you think are due to the AS. The one caveat here is that beware of the elderly patient, because they will frequently tell you, I feel fine, I'm not having any symptoms, and that is because they're not doing anything. They're just sitting around, they're very sedentary. So you have to be very pointed in your history taking, and in some cases, ask them to come in and do a stress test and walk on the treadmill to see whether they what they're telling you. In other words, they're not having any symptoms, they're doing fine, they can do whatever they want, is really the truth. Because frequently you'll get these patients on the treadmill and they can't even finish the first stage of a Bruce protocol, and they have an abnormal blood pressure response. In other words, they don't raise their blood pressure appropriately. And so there are other indications other than the most common one, i.e. development of symptoms in a patient with severe AS, that would prompt you to recommend aortic valve replacement. So these are listed here. So if they have severe AS, haven't yet developed symptoms, but have to undergo open heart surgery for some other reason, for example, they've been identified as having severe coronary disease, usually the valve's going to get replaced as well during that surgery. Also, patients that have very severe AS, and this is usually a mean gradient greater than 60 or peak flow velocity above 5. So if you have, and I've actually seen a number of patients like this, they are doing well, asymptomatic, and you're following their echo, and they occasionally will get to the point where they have very severe AS but have not yet developed symptoms. And this is a class 2A indication to recommend aortic valve replacement, so we would generally do that. Patients that have severe AS that keep telling me they're asymptomatic, I frequently will put them on the treadmill. It's not a treadmill that should be done by a nurse or mid-level. It's a treadmill that should be monitored by a cardiologist, because occasionally these patients can become hemodynamically unstable, but generally they'll do okay. And the point is to assess their functional status, and generally to get make sure you get an accurate assessment of their blood pressure change with continued exercise. Normally, blood pressure should rise with exercise, not drop. That's an abnormal finding. And there's some other reasons why. You can see that I've listed here, as I already mentioned, the importance of patients that with AS due to a bicuspid aortic valve, you need to make sure that you have adequately evaluated that ascending aorta. And if you identify a dilated ascending aorta, that needs to be followed serially over time, just like the valve. And generally, the present indication to recommend repair of the ascending aneurysm is once it reaches about 5.5 centimeters. There have been some previous guidelines, the AHA, ACC guidelines. They used to use a cutoff of 5, and they became a little bit more conservative with that, so that's an important number to remember. Low flow, low gradient aortic stenosis, I do want to mention this. So this is when there's marked discordance on the echo findings of the hemodynamics. So you have a calculated aortic valve area that is in the severe range, i.e. less than 1 centimeter squared, but with a peak flow velocity and or mean gradient that is in only the moderate range. And so what do you do about that? Well, a lot of those discrepant findings are frequently technically related to how they obtain the information at time of the echo to calculate the valve area. However, in patients that have reduced stroke volume, since gradients, just like with MS, with AS as well, gradients are driven by flow. So the greater flow across the valve, higher the gradient for any given valve area. Similarly, the lower the flow across the valve, the lower the gradient for any given valve area. So that's why in patients that develop dysfunction of the left ventricle for some reason, maybe they had an MI, or they develop a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy or whatever, but anything that reduces left ventricular function and therefore reduces stroke volume, i.e. flow across the aortic valve, will reduce the gradient. So you can see patients that have LV dysfunction who have less than a severe gradient but do have true severe aortic stenosis. It can be difficult to tease out the patients that have severe AS, truly have severe AS, from those that have a low calculated valve area but the really don't have a severely stenotic valve. It's just that the flow across the valve has been reduced, and therefore you end up with a calculated valve area that's low. And so this is where the use of low-dose dobutamine stress echo comes in. So what you do is you give dobutamine, and you reassess the hemodynamics or the flow across the aortic valve as you're infusing this. And patients that have true AS, the valve area will stay low. As you stimulate the ventricle, the stroke volume goes up, and the valve gradient will go up, so they'll approach hemodynamics that you would normally associate with severe AS, i.e. low valve area with a high gradient. Patients that are not able to achieve that, we tend to then lump into a group of patients that it's not the valve that's the problem, it's the ventricle. I know I'm running over, but there's a lot of stuff here to cover. AR, any abnormality of the leaflets or the aortic root can result in regurgitation across the aortic valve. And similar to MR, you have to be careful with these patients because symptoms may appear late. In other words, after they've developed dysfunction of the left ventricle, you do not want to allow that to occur, hopefully. So the ventricle may begin to fail before onset of symptoms. These eponym, is that the right word? Quincke's pulse, Corrigan's water hammer pulse, these are just terms that reply to physical exam findings that it's due to the ejection of a large stroke volume. Now, obviously, some of that then regurgitates back into the ventricle, but you get these bounding, wide pulse pressure, and so all these physical exam finding with severe AR are just related to that. The classic murmur is a diastolic decrescendo murmur. This can easily be missed because this tends to be a higher frequency murmur than what you would hear, say, with aortic stenosis. But generally, as aortic regurgitation becomes more severe, the murmur tends to become longer during diastole until the point where the ventricle starts to fail. In other words, where the left ventricular end diastolic pressure rises, and then actually the murmur can then start becoming shorter. So you have to be a little bit careful as far as relying on physical exam. Austin Flint murmur, I only put this in not because it's necessarily clinically relevant, although there's some clinical relevance, but they like that on board. So Austin Flint murmur is just a functional MS murmur. In other words, the patient doesn't have MS, but it sounds like they do because of early coaptation of the mitral leaflets because of the blood regurgitating back into the left ventricle, but you don't hear an opening snap with an Austin Flint murmur. With regurgitant lesions in general, don't forget about the option of ordering a cardiac MRA on these patients. Occasionally, if we have discrepancy between your clinical sense of what's going on with the patient and the echo findings, and you're really not sure, MRI is actually a very good test. It's very good at giving you information on regurgitant lesions, okay? This is just M-mode tracing showing fine fluttering of the anterior mitral leaflet. That's kind of an old slide. This is just showing you just a color flow signal coming. The aortic valve sits right here, so you can see a very mild jet of aortic regurgitation. This is a lot more significant jet. What constitutes or determines your grading system with echo is beyond the scope of this talk, but suffice it to say that echo generally does a pretty good job with quantifying AR, although sometimes I find that we do need to send these patients for cardiac MRI because it's not always clear on the echo. Once again, medical therapy is not a substitute for replacing the valve. You certainly want to control blood pressure in these patients, but really the important point here is the decision-making process as far as intervening and replacing the valve. So they have severe AR, they develop symptoms, that's kind of a no-brainer, but what about the asymptomatic patient that you think has severe AR? When do you recommend intervention? And it's not a small point, because if you have a patient that is telling you they're asymptomatic and they feel fine, and you're telling them, well, you need to go to the OR to have your valve replaced, that's, you know, it's, I think, something that needs to be taken seriously, because to be able to review with the patient why you're recommending such a big procedure in somebody that feels well. But there are indications to replace the valve, even though patients have not yet developed symptoms, if the ejection fraction starts to drop. So remember with MR, we said ejection fraction under 60%, a little more conservative with AR, ejection fraction, if it drops under 50% in the asymptomatic patient, that's an indication to replace the valve. And the other one that we commonly see is, even if the ejection fraction has not dropped significantly, but the left ventricle is getting big, that's another reason to recommend replacement of the valve. TS, rarely see it, can be due to the sequelae of rheumatic heart disease. Occasionally you can have congenital TS, but maybe from an internal medicine standpoint, you can see it also with carcinoid. It's very rare. TR actually, though, is very common, but most of these patients, it's just functional TR. In other words, they develop some problem with the right ventricle, usually due to elevated pulmonary pressures. The classic finding is a holosystolic murmur at the left sternal border, and for the sake of boards, should know what Carvello sign is. That just means that the intensity of the murmur increases with inspiration. Now, unlike MR, where you can't see the large V waves in the left atrium, with TR, actually someone with severe TR, you should be able to identify large V waves in the jugular pulse probably from across the exam room. If you've ever seen anybody with very severe tricuspid regurgitation, you walk in and you can just, walking toward the patient, you can see their neck veins just going like this. So large V waves or CV waves. And also, that's not rare either. If somebody has very severe TR, careful examination of the liver, you can feel hepatic pulsations from this regurgitant wave that is reflected back through the veins. That's just another example of a V wave. This is obviously in a right atrial tracing. For boards, the only thing on pulmonic regurg, know what a Gram-Steele murmur is, just a murmur of pulmonary regurgitation due to pulmonary hypertension. I'm going to stop here because I know I'm running over, and I'm going to finish this up with probably with the PAD lecture, which, because I think from an internal medicine board standpoint, probably a little bit less important for PAD, but need to get through this. So I'll come back. Congenital section is a lot shorter.